This is KDLG's Bristol Bay and Beyond for Friday, February 20. Thanks for joining us. Coming up this week, author Annie Bouchiver sits down to talk about her new novel set right here in a Bristol Bay summer. We'll get an update on how the fight against Pebble continues to go. Is Dillingham in the midst of its own peculiar form of a gas war? We sent a reporter to find out. Those plus thoughts from our occasional essayist, Clark Fair, about... Yes, it's that time of the year again, and we'll check in with some talented young folks heading to a state competition not involving a ball, a rim, or a mat. But first, a look back at some of the week's news. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski addressed a joint session of the Alaska legislature this week. Claiming not to be an alarmist, Murkowski told the state's lawmakers she believes President Obama is trying to starve the Trans-Alaska pipeline.
It looks like the goal is to shut down the pipeline. Now, they're not saying that, but when you don't, when you're working against those initiatives that would allow us to fill it up, how can you conclude otherwise?
Murkowski said the effect on the state would be devastating and said the new Congress is Alaska-friendly and will work to block the president's moves to shut off more of ANWR permanently to oil and gas development. Governor Bill Walker appointed three new members to the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation's board of directors this week, including Rick Halford. Halford, who has property just south of Aleknagik, is a former president of the Alaska Senate and has been a close advisor to Walker through the new governor's transition. The other two appointees are Joe Paskvin and Hugh Short. Dillingham police say they have not named any suspects in the Ella Olson homicide case. The town has been wild with rumors of arrests between Wednesday and Thursday. Chief Dan Pascarello told a public meeting Thursday night that two officers and a state trooper on loan from the Dillingham Post are tracking down and investigating every lead supplied by the public. He also said that heroin was sold out of the house Olson was found dead in up until the night before she was killed. Another Bristol Bay murder case came a step closer to resolution this week. 19-year-old Brandon Lee Black of Washington State pleaded guilty to a reduced manslaughter charge for killing 68-year-old Alex Olympic and Non Dalton in the spring of 2012. Black will likely receive a flat 15-year jail sentence at a sentencing hearing scheduled for May. Last fall, Vitus Fuels opened for business in Dillingham, selling gas and fuel out of the Teddy's convenience store on Lake Road. Between their entry into the market, Dillingham's now third retail fuel supplier, the lower-than-average fuel sales in town this winter for a number of reasons, and the low price of oil on the world market, Dillingham customers are starting to see, finally, a little competition for business at the pump. We sent our reporter Matt Martin to check around town, and he joins me now. Matt, so first question... Did you find a cheapest price of gas in town, and where was it?
Cheapest place to buy, Wednesdays and Thursdays at Delta Western. Price is $6.33 a gallon.
Well, is that their normal price?
No, that's not their normal price. They have a special deal. Back in January, they posted on the trading post on Facebook saying it was their Thirsty Thursday. They now expanded it to include Wednesday, but they have cheaper prices on those days. And this week, the price kind of fluctuates every week, but this week it was... $6.33 compared to their normal price of $6.65.
Okay, and what about their competitors? Their main competitor downtown is the Bristol Express. What did you find there?
I found that their normal price is $6.69, and Wednesdays and Thursdays it was $6.39.
Oh, they've also gone to Wednesdays and Thursdays.
Yeah, the Bristol Express told me that after Delta Western did their Thirsty Thursdays, they had to follow suit. They didn't have any choice.
This sounds like a gas war to me. I don't know. Well, what about Teddy's up the road now? This is our newest, and they're out of the way a little bit, but they came in and they brought the cheapest price to town back in the fall. What about now?
They told me they're not playing any games. They're not doing Thirsty Thursday. They're just going to have low prices always. And right now, when I talked to them 2 days ago, their price was $6.71. But an interesting thing that they told me was that once the barges come May sometime, they plan on cutting their prices in half.
They're going to cut their gas prices in half when the barge gets here.
That's what they told me. We'll see what happens come May.
Well, this is going to be a good summer. Let's clarify one thing, though. I said Teddy's, and what we mean is Teddy's now owned by Vitus, which is our third fuel distributor in town.
Yeah.
I wasn't clear on that, so Vitus, okay.
One interesting point about having three gas stations or fuel providers in town is something that Ken at Delta Western told me, is that he doesn't think that three stations are going to be able to survive here. And he said that eventually down the road, one of them is going to cave, and it just depends on whose pockets are the deepest.
Interesting. All right. Well, so far it's been good news for the consumer. What did you find out about home heating oil, which many are not using so much of this winter? Cheapest place in town.
Cheapest place in town is Mondays at Delta Western. They have a cash deal that if you pay in cash on Monday, you get it for $4.23.
That's not bad.
Not bad.
Did you talk to any consumers at the pump?
I did. I spoke with one woman who told me that she specifically comes on Wednesdays and Thursdays because it's the cheapest day and she has a couple kids to take care of, so she has to make that dollar stretch.
Everybody is satisfied with, as she was, with the lower prices?
I spoke with one man who was up here for work from Washington State, and he had a bit of a sticker shock when he got up here. He had this to say.
And with, like, our discount, like a Safeway discount, we were getting gasoline down there for, like, $2.10 a gallon for premium. So up here, three times more expensive than back home. So it's still a big change.
Well, we can't please them all, but it seems like pretty good news for the consumer. I guess we'll wait and find out how our suppliers do when the barges come in and see how this affects their bottom line. But for now, it seems like good news for most of us.
Yeah, I think it is a good news for the consumer.
All right. Matt Martin at KDLG. Thanks much. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. Back in a moment. Weeks ago on this program, Tom Collier, the CEO of the Pebble Mine, discussed the lawsuit Pebble has filed against the EPA in federal court, which has temporarily stopped the agency from doing any more work towards what some call the preemptive veto of the Pebble Mine. Collier believes Pebble will prevail in this lawsuit. He also told us then that he's confident the project will move forward. Tom, here we are at the start of 2015. Do you believe there will be a Pebble Mine?
Absolutely. We're going to get a permit. We're going to build this mine.
On the other side, the coalition battling Pebble is continuing to press their case when and where they can. Joining us now to talk more about that is Alana Hurley with the organization United Tribes of Bristol Bay. Hurley is speaking to us by phone from Anchorage, where after a work trip to the nation's capital, she was joining others at the Alaska premiere of the Breach film. Alana, good to speak with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Dave.
And so you and others have been in the nation's capital this week to talk about some issues directly related to the EPA's involvement in this ongoing debate. Tell me more.
Yes. Yeah, so a coalition of Bristol Bay tribes, village corporations, Alaska Native corporations, commercial fishermen, sport fishermen, and conservation groups were in D.C., last week, speaking specifically about Senate Bill 234 that was introduced by Senator Vitter from Louisiana and co-sponsored by Senator Manchin from West Virginia, directly attacking and attempting to gut the Clean Water Act of EPA's 404C authority to preemptively and retroactively use their 404C authority on 404 permits. This is extremely concerning for Bristol Bay tribes, due to the fact that if this bill were to go anywhere, it would take us 10 steps backwards in all the progress we've made with the EPA and the current 404C process we're in with them right now.
So this piece of legislation, I think it came up in Congress last year by these same two sponsors, but it didn't go very far. Are you getting a different sense now with a new Congress? What was your take?
I think we're definitely concerned with the new Congress and the shift in dynamics there. We're definitely putting our feet to the ground to make sure that the decision makers and legislators back in D.C. understand Bristol Bay's perspective and understand that we invited EPA into Bristol Bay and are gonna fight to protect that authority for them to make these proactive restrictions in our region. And we will not rest until we know that it's not going to be decided on a rider or some legislation back in D.C.
Alana, let me ask you about the progress with EPA. Stepping back a little bit and taking a wider perspective, it seems like some of that progress has stalled, whether it's for the time being or if this is a setback. But this the EPA's involvement is before a U.S. federal judge in Anchorage to decide whether or not it's been done improperly. And before he decides one way or the other, the EPA has been ordered to halt for the time being. Where does that leave the coalition working to oppose PEBL right now?
Well, of course, the tribes were disappointed with the delay, but we're very optimistic that, next month the injunction will be lifted and we'll be able to move forward in this 404C process. Right now, we're just definitely keeping our feet to the ground on any legislative attacks to EPA's 404C authority in Congress, and making sure that we're ready to move forward once the injunction is lifted.
Are you hearing that the judge will make a further ruling in this case sooner rather than later this year?
I think that it's expected to come out this spring, and I think we're very optimistic that PEBL's claims here are outrageous and insulting to the local people of Bristol Bay who have participated in this open public process that PEBL is claiming it was illegal. So this is just more of the same from the PEBL partnership on their last legs, disregarding and disrespecting the people of Bristol Bay. So we're super optimistic that the process is going to move forward here in the next couple months.
It seems like those of you who are working in the federal arena, encouraging the EPA to bring about these restrictions that more likely than not would prevent a pebble-sized mine and most other sized mines in that area, it seems like you still have work in front of you. Is that the case?
Yeah, no, I think that the tribes especially know that this isn't over until it's over, and that we're halfway through the process. We're nowhere near completed. PEBL is not dead, as they've said themselves. They're, you know, aggressively looking for future or another investor into the project when they lost Anglo American last year or 2 years ago. I think that the long-term protection of our region is definitely an ongoing fight, but I think we're definitely going to see the end of PEBL soon. So we're very optimistic that we're definitely going to move forward and secure long-lasting, long-term protections for our watershed.
Alana Hurley with the United Tribes of Bristol Bay, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Dave.
You might have heard, I hope you've heard now, of a novel called Bristol Bay Summer. Set in the early 1980s, this novel chronicles 12-year-old Zoe Morley, who accompanies her younger brother, her mom, and her mom's bush pilot boyfriend to a setnet camp on Half Moon Bay near Naknek. It is a beautifully told coming-of-age tale, vividly set here in our backyard. The author, Annie Bucheever, is in Dillingham this week. I asked her to read a passage as Zoe picks her first fish out of a setnet.
Zoe reached one hand into the icy water and grabbed a salmon's head, then pushed two fingers of her other hand under its gill. Through the glove, she could feel the thin membrane under the gills give way. The heavy fish shook twice. "It's wiggling!" Zoe yelled, yanking her hands away from the fish. It fell back into the net, shook for a few seconds, then still. "That's what we want. We don't like them to drown in the net. And we want to keep the net as empty as we can so the new fish don't get scared away." That made perfect sense. What was she afraid of, anyway? Zoe was determined not to look like a helpless city girl.
Annie Bucheever, thank you so much for joining us. What prompted you to set your first novel in Bristol Bay, Alaska? You have some history here, I gather.
I do. Not very much, but what I had a big impact on me. I came here over 30 years ago. It was around 1980, and I came with my two kids, who at the time were 4 and 6. I was a single mother and newly divorced, and I had a bush pilot boyfriend. And
I'm recognizing some of the theme or some of the characters in this book.
The book is very much based on real life. But I didn't even get to stay for the whole season. But it just left this huge mark. I was so impressed with the place, the people, the way of life. I had never seen anything like it. And I'm a born and raised Alaskan from Juneau, but it's really different there. And it just left a huge impression on me, and I always thought about it. And it took 30 years to get to where I had enough still time where I could actually write it.
So your only real time spent in Bristol Bay was 30 years ago, and it resulted in this novel.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Well, I did a lot of research. I had a lot of friends who had been here. And I came back about 4 or 5 years ago and spent a little bit of time in Naknek doing more research, talking to people. Because even though the book is fiction, I really wanted to make the descriptions and the place and the whole ancient art of set net fishing as real as I could make it.
Let me ask you about that, because you grabbed a lot of the imagery that I'm sure resonates with any readers from here and really puts a nice, vivid description of the region for readers outside of here. There's the 40-horse Johnson outboard motor. There are the Ulu knives. People don't drive trucks. They drive rigs and on and on. What was your favorite imagery to make sure that you included?
Well, I don't know. You're jogging my memory about the 40-horse Johnson, and I definitely, you know, even though we didn't have a set net site in Bristol Bay, I did grow up with a dad who loved to fish, and we spent a lot of time fly fishing in little creeks and lakes nearby in Juneau, and so I had a lot of experience in skiffs and old motors like that.
There's kind of a nostalgic twist to the novel as well, that the young adults, I would like to know how they read into that, that there's no email, there's no smartphones, she's sending letters. There's talk of Cyndi Lauper and Indiana Jones. They probably don't even know who these people are now, unless they Google it on their smartphones.
Right,
What are you hearing about using that element?
Yeah, it's a good question. I know that when I was writing it, I got some criticism from some of the readers that worked with me who thought, oh, I think you need to make it in contemporary times. And I guess the reason I was resistant partly is because I think of it as kind of a timeless story. And actually, 30 years ago, the way they set net fish is not all that different from the way that they do it today. And half the time, the cell phones don't work in those, you know, kind of more remote areas. And you can't play video games when you're out there because you're not able to do that. So checkers and,
right.
You know, those old things. So then I decided, and it was a big decision to go contemporary or stay with the time period. So I decided, okay, if I'm going to stay with the time period, I need to make it that time period. So I made sure, like I looked it up, and Cyndi Lauper, sure enough, she was at that time. And so all the way along, I checked it so that it really was actually like it, 1980.
I love that Zoe has to take an hour boat ride to get to a payphone to make a very critical phone call in the story. That's so much more powerful than waiting to get 4 bars enough climbing up on the grass. And I hope that resonates with the young audience. I hope that is important to them. And letters lost or letters undelivered. Very
mm-hmm.
powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Was that intentional?
Yes. I mean, I guess maybe I hadn't really thought about the boat ride to make the phone call. But I mean, I grew up in that time period, and that's almost more the norm for me than to think of the cell phones. I mean, that seems very normal because that's what it was like.
So you published in May. What have you had the chance to talk to young readers about with this book?
Well, they're really interested in the juxtaposition of a real life event and how I made that into a story and what was real and what was made up. I don't know why, but that seems to be one of their biggest interests. And so I spent a lot of time answering questions like, you know, did you marry Patrick? And
did you marry Patrick?
No, I didn't.
Oh.
No.
Is Patrick somewhere in our listening audience today?
He is a fisherman in Bristol Bay, and
okay.
I do definitely have contact with him, and he was absolutely ecstatic about the book.
This wasn't a memoir, so there's fictional elements added. Only you probably know just how much is or how close to the truth it comes. But did you enjoy writing something that was so close to your own story, but turning it into a fiction?
I did.
Fictional.
I liked that a lot about it. Part of why I wanted to write the book was, I was divorced. My kids were. I was a single mom, and it was a really tough time for me and for my kids. And then
Of course, I was a teacher for many, many years, and saw the what divorce has done to kids and the effect it's had on kids, and so I wanted to kind of get into that whole thing and live it again and feel it, and especially do it from my daughter's point of view. And the character Zoe is modeled after my real daughter, Leora. And I mean, it was kind of a healing, really, to do that. And I think for her, too. And her little brother, it's my oldest son now. But so it was, in a way, very biographical and kind of a healing. And then also because I mean, that was the message that I wanted to get out with the book, was I wanted this to be a hopeful book for kids that are going through that, so that they can see there may be a light at the end of the tunnel and that they're not the only one that's dealing with that kind of issue.
I noticed that the Bristol Bay Times makes an appearance in the latter half of the book. Was there KDLG didn't reach Half Moon Bay back then? It would have alerted them to the storm. They wouldn't have taken off that day. The marine weather forecast.
Oh.
We won't take it personally. Well, Annie Boutchever, author of Bristol Bay Summer, published last May. The novel was a pleasure, as was our time here together today. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a really privilege and a delight to be here.
We have fished close into shore. We have gone out farther. We have crossed the harbor bar. Also the bars in the harbor. We're not the masters of our fate, but no man is our master. So we raise our glasses high to drink to the beauty of Alaska.
Their arena is not a court or a mat, and rarely will their events sell out the stands like other teams. But some impressive young men caught our attention this week as they prepared to travel to their own state competition in Anchorage. KDLG's Hannah Colton stopped by the Dillingham speech and debate team during one of their final practices, and she brought us this report.
It's the old man from scene 24.
What is he doing here?
He is the keeper of the Bridge of Death.
It's 4 o'clock on a Tuesday afternoon. Class just let out, and 5 students meet in the high school science classroom. They push chairs out of the way, set up metal music stands in a row, and pull out copies of scripts. It's the Dillingham High School speech and debate team.
My name is Elijah Hunt.
I'm Marshall Johnson.
My name is Danny Miller.
Darren Napoli.
My name is Jay Lee.
These guys are rehearsing for their biggest event of the year. They're working on a bit that's sure to be a crowd pleaser.
Yes? Brave Sir Robin, you go.
I got a great idea. Why doesn't Lancelot go?
Yes! Dead. Let me go, my liege! I shall take him single-handedly. I shall make him bait to the door!
No. Hang on. Just
that's senior Marshall Johnson. He's like my spirit guide for speech and debate. He explains that speech has lots of different categories. There's solo acting.
Extemporaneous speaking.
Duo interpretation, dramatic interpretation.
And then we have a reader's theater.
There are rules for each of these categories. For example, reader's theater.
You get stands and scripts.
No props. Everyone stands in a line. You face straight ahead. But there's still room for creativity.
Like for the opening scene of Monty Python, we pretend to ride a horse.
Knights,
we jump
forward.
And this is a radio, so you probably didn't see me jump.
Arthur, King of the Britons.
Original oration is another category. For this one, you take a stance on a controversial topic, then you have 8 minutes to try to convince your audience to think like you. Students can pick any topic they want.
So it doesn't have to be some kind of like life or death situation thing. It doesn't have to be about the bombs launched in Syria.
Senior Jay Lee will give his original oration on how video games are actually good for us.
I'm a very avid gamer, so I thought it would be something that would be easy and interesting to do.
And he wants to change like how the school system and how the populace views video games.
Most people think that video games are actually a bad connotation, but I believe that video games can be a more beneficial tool to society.
This weekend, the speech and debate team performs in their various categories at the state competition in Anchorage. Whether they're trying to change societal norms or just looking to get some laughs, this crew is dedicated to giving a convincing performance.
Now, forth we ride to the Knights of Knee, to whom we owe a shrubbery. Oh, Knights of Knee, we have brought you your shrubbery. May we go now?
It is a good shrubbery.
I like the laws particularly. But there is one small problem.
What is that?
We are now no longer the Knights who say ni.
Ni, ni.
Shh! We are now the Knights who say Icky, 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 Peking, Zumbong.
Ni, ni.
Therefore, we must...
For KDLG, I'm Hannah Colton.
And we'll end this week's show with an essay. As I read this, I stare out at a mostly bare and soggy tundra on a warm, what feels like spring, day here in the month of February. It has not been a good winter for us, again, and next week's Beaver Roundup will surely suffer a bit. But as our occasional essayist Clark Fair reminds us, the beloved annual celebration is about more than just the races, the prizes, and those beaver buns.
During Beaver Roundup last year, I was sitting in our Bayside apartment when my girlfriend sent me a text message. At 2 p.m., there will be a candy drop from an airplane. Don't miss it. She'd spoken to the pilot of a red Super Cub who would be flying in low over Dillingham to drop candy and prizes for kids. I hurried downtown, but Main Street was oddly deserted. Unbeknownst to me, the drop site had been changed, and when the Super Cub flew directly over my head a few minutes later, not so much as a Tootsie Roll spiraled to the ground. Instead, the plane banked north for the water tower. Moments later, it dived out of sight, and I heard children cheering. Through slushy streets, I ran all the way to the fenced-in playground by the water tower, just as the plane was returning. Inside the fence surged a herd of youngsters, brandishing plastic grocery sacks as they sloshed over wet grass for goodies spinning earthward. Watching, I was swept with nostalgia. All week, I'd been flashing back to my years in South Central Alaska, feasting on beluga burgers at the Kenai Days barbecue, watching the rodeo during Soldotna Progress Days or the Iditarod start at Fur Rendezvous, food tasting with my kids at the Kenai River Festival, and admiring ice sculptures during the Peninsula Winter Games. Beaver Roundup was like all those things in one neat little homespun bundle. Although poor snow conditions canceled all the sled dog and snowmobile competitions last year, the rest of the events proceeded as planned. Cars and people thronged Main Street for about 30 to 40 minutes of parade action and flying candy. The fun run and the outhouse race were brief but exciting, and I enjoyed the pickled salmon and agouti competitions, dilly capers, the chili and chowder cook-offs, the crafts fair, and the fireworks finale at the harbor. For most of the winter, life in Dillingham is slow. But during Beaver Roundup, the energy is palpable and frenetic. Everybody, it seems, comes out for at least one event, be it frozen turkey bowling, the traditional foods feast, live music from the New Stew Band, or Dillingham Idol. Beaver Roundup, like Fur Rendezvous, developed around the traditional gathering of local trappers bringing their pelts to market. Since those trappers had sled dog teams, it was only natural for some competition to evolve. At the very first Beaver Roundup, 26 teams battled for honors. Then, over the years, the gathering grew into a multi-day affair with a wide variety of events. Of course, not every event survived its debut. A number of years ago, two pilots competed to see whose airplane propeller could break the most balloons. Fortunately, no one was seriously injured. Despite uncooperative weather last year, Beaver Roundup reminded everyone again of the spirit of community and the uniqueness of Western Bristol Bay. And that, I think, is what's really important. These celebrations are filled with real rural citizens coming together with everything they've got. Local residents make the floats, drive the cars, and toss the candy. And if our brief parades sometimes seem a little hokey and are jam-packed with ordinary folks, it's because it's supposed to be that way. That's who we are. The residents of rural Alaska and small towns everywhere, holding up a virtual mirror to ourselves and doing the best we can.
We've had 40 years of Roundup, and we'd like at least 40 more of good time celebration on the new Shagak shores. Beaver Roundup, up by the shores of the new Shagak, Beaver Roundup. When the trappers all come back, Beaver Roundup. Where we gather in.
That's it for this week's Bristol Bay and Beyond. Our news magazine heard Fridays at 12 noon and at 6:30 p.m. on the AM KDLG channel and at 8:30 p.m. on the FM. Send us feedback and ideas to news@kdlg.org or dave@kdlg.org. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. See you here next week.
Where we gather in the old familiar way and celebrate the Roundup time in Dillingham, A.K. Thank you very much.